Our final case of the day, in re interest of Cordell M. In re interest of Cordell M.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Karen Nelson. I represent Stacey Moxie in this matter. One of my favorite quotations from Mark Twain is, it's not what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for certain that simply ain't so. It's what gets you into trouble. This case, after briefly reviewing the facts and the assignments of errors in the state's response, I'll explain what simply isn't so in this case. This is a case that was filed by the Cass County Attorney's Office in late July 2020, and Stacey Moxie's children were removed from her care and custody. Detention hearing occurred on or about August 5th of 2020. At that time, the standard rules of law applied. Ms. Moxie was advised that the Indian Child Welfare Act may apply. Shortly thereafter, somewhere around August 11th, a notice was sent to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is required anytime you know or may suspect or reasonably suspect that a child might be subject to the Indian Child Welfare Act.
And your client received a copy of that?
She was mailed a copy, but there's no evidence that it was mailed via registered or certified mail, and there's no return of that filed with the court.
Okay. The certificate of service on there says registered and certified, but you're saying there's no proof that that was accomplished.
There's no proof that was accomplished because there was no green card filed with court or any other evidence that you would suspect when you get certified or registered mail. I would point out to the court that simply giving notice to the Bureau of Indian Affairs and then to the client via certified mail is not enough to give her notice that the Indian Child Welfare Act applies. This is what simply ain't so. That's notice that this may be a case, and it's an invitation for the individual tribe or Bureau of Indian Affairs to reply and give notice whether the juvenile is subject to the Indian Child Welfare Act by either being registered or eligible for registry in the tribe.
But isn't that the notice that 43-1505 requires? It's that initial notification, right?
I think that's required. But when you find out that, in fact, a child is eligible for enrollment, in this case, the Rosebud Sioux Tribe gave notice on September 15th, 2020, that, in fact, the child was eligible for enrollment and that they were intervening, no notice was given to the mother. That I think that's the triggering event, the Indian Child Welfare Act.
And that notice is required by what?
I think just fundamentally as a process of due process, you're entitled to notice that, in fact, your child's registered or eligible for enrollment and that the Indian Child Welfare Act has been triggered and that the tribe is intervening.
And there was only one of the three children that came under the ICWA. Is that correct?
That would be correct. It's Dimitri Moxie right. That is
the other two were not affected by that.
The other two were not affected. I'd point out to the court that Clarence, the father, the oldest child has aged out at this point, is no longer subject to the jurisdiction of the court, and Cordell is subject to a guardianship. And court has terminated jurisdiction on him as well. So Dimitri's the only remaining child.
Was the argument presented to Judge Gindler at the trial level that she had not been properly notified?
I believe clearly it was. On January 20th, that's when the mother and counsel learned, and it wasn't just mother's counsel, but father's counsel as well as GAL, believe the court indicated that day.
But wasn't mother's counsel, didn't she say she couldn't remember whether she had received notice or not? She wasn't sure of that.
That might have been what was said, But the record's clear that the September 15th, 2020 intervention and actually triggering event was not supplied to any of the other legal parties. And there's no evidence that mother or counsel received that.
So what's the substance though of the objection here? She showed up for the January 20th hearing. She was there for a purpose. She had knowledge before that possibly ICWA would apply. But, you know, what's the substance of the objection?
The substance of the objection is that the mother was there on January 20th for a motion to compel the department's compliance with the August 5th, 2020 order regarding the therapeutic visit. It wasn't there for a continued detention hearing, a new detention hearing, or anything else. So counsel and mother show up expecting one hearing, and because the court and everyone else figures out this is an ICWA case and we need a new detention hearing, it magically transforms to a new protective custody hearing without any real notice.
Okay, so the substance of your argument here is that the mother was entitled to notice that we're now going to have another detention hearing because ICWA applies, and she wasn't provided with notice of that? That's your position?
That is my position, as well as the fact that there was unreasonable delay between September 15th and January 20th. Court heard evidence at that time, but didn't make what I would consider a final determination, left things up in the air for parties to meet, some therapists to meet, and was going to be called back in March. That's what happened. And at that time, the final detention order was issued.
So this is not like a normal case where there was no detention hearing. There was a detention hearing. It's just that at the time they had the initial detention hearing, they didn't realize that ICWA applied.
That would be correct.
Okay, so then they have to come back after giving notice, having people have opportunity to intervene, and then set a subsequent hearing under those circumstances.
Correct. The heightened standards of ICWA would have applied, which were not applied at the August 5th hearing. That's the increased burden of proof, the requirement that there be a qualified expert witness regarding serious emotional or physical harm mm-hmm. to the child, those kind of things, which were simply not done at the August hearing.
Because they didn't know, but that's why they had the January hearing, so they can complete that process, which you say that your counsel didn't know that that's what the nature of the hearing, or what your client did.
There is absolutely no notice anywhere in the record that that January 20th hearing was going to be anything other than a motion to compel compliance with the August 5th, 2020 order. I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal if I could.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Sutter, and I'm a deputy county attorney in Cass County, and I represent the appellee state of Nebraska in this matter. The state is respectfully requesting that this court enter an order affirming the order of the county court sitting as a juvenile court in this matter.
What was the mother properly notified?
I believe, as far as the applicability of the Indian Child Welfare Act, I yes. believe that the notice that the department sent, which was sent to the mother, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the Rosebud Sioux Tribe was sufficient under the Indian Child Welfare Act to notify the mother of the potential that ICWA applied.
Was it sent by certified or registered mail?
It was sent by the Department of Health and Human Services, so I can't speak to that. I can only read what they put on their certificate of service as far as what method the department used to send to those three parties.
Go ahead.
Well, what about the January 20th hearing? She's suggesting that the client wasn't on notice that we're going to have this now, you know, continued detention hearing. You started with chapter one in August, and now you're going to go with chapter two because you found out about ICWA, and she's suggesting that she wasn't put on notice of that. How do you respond to that?
I agree there's nothing in the record that says that it was specifically set for a detention hearing on that day, but there were discussions off the record between the parties as to the applicability of ICWA and the need for the state to have a qualified expert witness testify at that hearing. And so at the January hearing, the courts again advised both parents of the heightened standards of the Indian Child Welfare Act. The state presented evidence of a qualified expert witness, and based on some of the parties' representations that they didn't have notice that that was what was going to be heard that day, the court entered interim orders and continued the matter to be heard for further evidence as to active efforts, as well as the serious emotional or physical.
Was there any objection at that hearing by the mother, or motion for a continuance or anything, once she realized that the court wanted to go forward with an ICWA hearing that day?
I think there was, Your Honor. I think there was, but there was also no objection to the court when it laid out how it intended to proceed, essentially continuing the matter for further evidence, setting the matter for a pretrial, and then eventually the March hearing. In the interim, the mother did file some objections, I believe, are a part of the record as well.
Thank you.
The counsel for the mother, or the mother, addressed other assignments of error, and I would just like to address those briefly. The state had filed an amended juvenile court petition. The mother had asked for a dismissal of the state's amended petition, and the juvenile court overruled the motion to dismiss and granted the state leave to amend. And I think that assignment of error is without merit, because in the case, in the interest of Sabrina, a 2001 case, the court stated that when a demur to a petition is sustained, a court must grant leave to amend the petition unless it is clear that no reasonable possibility exists that amendment will correct the defect. There was no evidence presented, and there was nothing in the record in the present case that made it clear that no reasonable possibility existed.
Is that a final order?
As far as the court's...
The court overruling the motion to dismiss because the pleading is in allowing to amend. Is that even an appealable order?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. If the court finds that it is, I think that there's clear that the defect could be corrected, and it was in fact corrected. So I think that assignment of error is without merit. The mother also appealed the court's findings as to the active efforts, as well as the serious emotional or physical damage provisions of the Indian Child Welfare Act. And I would note, as outlined in the state's brief, that as far as the active efforts element is concerned, that the burden of proof is a preponderance of the evidence. It's not clear and convincing evidence. So I think that there's clearly sufficient evidence in the record to show that there's a preponderance of the evidence that the state or the department made active efforts as required under 43-1505 subsection 4.
At the March 10th hearing, was there any further objection to proceeding forward, or both sides presented what they wanted to present?
The mother had filed a motion to dismiss, and I believe she also filed an objection at that time, and the court overruled her motions and then allowed for the hearing to continue. The state presented its evidence, evidence at that time.
Did she present evidence at that hearing?
I don't believe she did, Your Honor. Uh, As far as the serious emotional or physical damage to the child, that's part of 43-1505 subsection 5. I think one of the arguments that appellant made in her brief is that one, there wasn't sufficient evidence, and two, that it wasn't specifically stated in the order. The January order referenced that Dimitri would face imminent harm if he were to return home. The March 11th order stated that, well, the court specifically referenced that the state had met the burden outlined in 43-1505 subsection 5, though it didn't specifically use a serious emotional or physical damage to the child language. I think that the court's use of the word imminent is merely harmless error in this case, because looking at in the interest of Enrique P., in that case, the court did not articulate in its order a specific standing by which it made its findings related to the foster care placement of the child, nor did it make a finding supported by a testimony of a qualified expert witness that active efforts had been made. The Court of Appeals found that any error related to the juvenile court's failure to specifically state the foregoing was harmless error, and that the evidence would have supported those ICWA findings. So I think the court's use of the word imminent harm or the phrase imminent harm is harmless error, because I think the record clearly would support a finding that serious emotional or physical damage would likely result if Dimitri were to return home to his mother. And then as far as the March 11th order is concerned, again, if the court finds that the juvenile court's failure to use that specific language is an error, I believe that also is harmless error, because the record would support a finding of the serious emotional or physical damage to the child as well. State would ask that the court affirm the order of the juvenile court if there are no further questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appellant appears to have 2 minutes and 31 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would suggest to the court that between the January 20th hearing and the March 11th hearing, that both a motion to dismiss and an objection were filed with the court. I would point out to this court that in a motion to dismiss, if evidence is offered, that I think that transforms it into a motion for summary judgment, and those rules apply. Obviously, I think I argued that based on the evidence and the motions before the court, those were overruled. I do want to take a minute and focus on the active efforts piece of this. In order for the court to detain Dimitri, the court needed to find both that there were active efforts, and part of the active efforts piece included a cultural plan. The state's own witness on March 11th, Ms. Bad Moon testified that the cultural plan was, I think the word she used was insufficient. Additionally, active efforts and the definition of that contemplates something more than reasonable efforts. In this case, it's very clear from the evidence that was produced and procured at the hearing that there was an order for therapeutic visits, and those had never started. My assertion to this court that the therapeutic visits and following the orders as set forth by the court was part of the active efforts, and then in this case, it just simply did not occur. So the court could not have found active efforts on either January 20th or March 11th. And regarding Enrique P., when I read that decision, I don't think that there was an incorrect standard used, but no standard. And the court, when reviewing that, determined that their de novo review suggested there was sufficient evidence to find serious emotional or physical damage to the minor child. In this case, both at the January 20th and March 11th hearings, I think initially Ms. Marcantel and then Ms. Badwin, I think that there was insufficient evidence to find that there was serious, there was evidence of serious and emotional and physical damage to the child. For that reason, I don't think that prong was met either. I think with that, I timed it well and I'm out of time.
Thank you. Very nicely done. Thank you.
The case is submitted. Council is excused, and that concludes our December panel. Thank you.